From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Obviously, working in a correctional facility entails a certain amount of risk, and every one of the individuals here is keenly aware of that. But they should not be placed at unnecessary risk. And that, as you can see, I think, in several of these situations, is exactly what's happening.
To prevent a scenario where a lone officer was assaulted and couldn't open the electric door for backup, we asked for a second healthcare officer. Management told us no. That scenario is exactly what happened. Literally the next day, we got what we asked for 2 months earlier. I just wish an officer didn't have to be injured to make that happen.
We take staff safety very seriously, very seriously. Everybody in corrections does. It's not a union issue, it's not a management issue. It's the staff of corrections take it very seriously.
They've admitted that there are more than 2,000 people in the department who should have been seen by psychiatrists who have not been. They're working to get that backlog down, but frankly, over the summer, since we've been discussing things, that backlog has increased rather than decreased. They can't fix the system without spending a lot more money.
That's Alan Mills. He's the Uptown People's Law Center, and also John Baldwin, Department of Corrections Director before that. Also in there, we did hear from a correctional officer, Cody Canope. He's with the Lawrence Correctional Center, and AFSCME's Executive Director, Roberta Lynch, at the start. There are concerns over assaults on prison workers, AFSCME raising this issue this week. Also, the field of candidates for governor has gotten a bit smaller. We'll talk about that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie is director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. And in our Statehouse Bureau, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio Statehouse reporter, and our guest today, John O'Connor, political writer for the Associated Press. And John, good to have you on once again.
Thank you, Sean.
Brian, I'll go to you first, I guess, on this prison situation and what's happening there. What appears to be the problem?
Well, the AFSCME union says there has been a significant increase in the attacks on prison guards. They say, 51% over the last three calendar years. That includes a projection of the numbers they expect based on the first 7 months of this year. The Department of Corrections doesn't actually dispute that. They also see an increase, a smaller increase in the 30 to 40% range, but they're using a slightly different metric, so it's not quite an apples to apples comparison. They base it on fiscal years, not calendar years, but the bigger picture is that they do acknowledge the increase. They say there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them has to do with inmates who have mental health disorders. And they say that, yes, they are trying to treat those people differently. In the past, they might have just locked them up and thrown away the key, so to speak. Although, I mean, they would not put it that way. But that's what the lawyers for those thousands of inmates in a class action have said. And now that they are trying to do treatment under pressure from this lawsuit, and they settled this lawsuit by agreeing to take all these steps. The prison guard saying, well, you can't just stop punishing inmates with nothing to replace it. And DOC is having a hard time recruiting psychiatrists and psychologists and the people they need to really ramp up this program. But ultimately, I think it is interesting, and John, you can talk about this. It is not necessarily the common response of DOC when the union complains about something to say, yes, we acknowledge that, you know, at least even the numbers, we agree that, there is this increase happening. But there is something else to think about, which is how you define assault, right? The union is highlighting the terrible incidents where people end up going to the hospital, they're off work for a long time. Corrections points out that does happen, but it's a smaller share. The majority of assaults are actually just inmates maybe could be bumping into you in the line, and that's considered an assault. Or even throwing bodily fluids at a guard. As disgusting as that is, that still counts as an assault, but it's not necessarily something that would, have somebody be hospitalized and be off work for a long time.
So does AFSCME want, what do they want, I guess, out of this? Do they want more people? That seems to usually be what the union has pushed for, that they feel as though there needs to be more guards and more people who work in the prisons. Is that what they're saying here? Is there something else that they want?
This is an interesting twist to this. We go through this every few years. There is a spike here or a spike there, and there's some conversation about what's going on. Ask Me This Time says that one of the major drivers here is Governor Bruce Rauner, the Republican governor, has called for a 25% reduction in the prison population, which we know spiked several years ago under Governor Pat Quinn. And too many people are locked up. The prisons are overtaxed. Well, what Ask Me says is what's happening is that inmates are being reclassified. There's pressure on counselors in the prisons who classify the threat level of prisoners, and that when we talk about shortening sentences or giving more good time, you would expect to see the effects of that at the minimum security level, the lower level security prisons where there are nonviolent offenders being held. Instead, Ask Me says there's an 18% decrease in the populations at maximum security prisons, and they wonder whether corrections is purposely downgrading the threat level of these maximum security prisoners and putting them in medium security prisons, which are less costly to operate and have fewer staff members, therefore driving the number of assaults. Correction says, no, that's not the case. We do reclassify prisoners on an annual basis, and classify prisoners based on their progress. So, yes, if there is a person serving 20 years for murder and he's within 4 or 5 years of release to the community, we do need to, and he's shown progress and behaved himself, we do need to prepare him for reentry into the community. So there will be cases where someone serving a sentence for murder is at a lower level security prison, but not if he doesn't deserve to be there.
Charlie, you've been listening to this. Does it make sense to you as far as what AFSCME is saying on this?
Yeah, and I think the bottom line from the clips that we heard and from the discussion is we have to invest more in our correctional system. And it's been something that's been known for years. We mentioned the fact that Pat Quinn had an early release program that came under a lot of criticism because some prisoners were being let out within a day or so of the time they arrived because of the time that they had served at the county jail level. And so there was a shutdown on the early release program and the prisons spiked. But our prison population, if you look historically since the 80s and the war on drugs, it's increased dramatically. For a while, we were building a new prison a year. We went from something like 4,000 inmates in the late 70s and a prison budget of maybe $200 million a year to now we have like 42,000 in the institutions, and the budget is in excess of $1 billion. A lot of it had to do with the punitive way we came down on drugs. And it requires money. We heard the clip about not having enough psychiatrists to deal with people who have mental issues. I forget the percentage, but a significant number of the people who are locked up do have mental issues. They're mentally ill. They need treatment, and we're not investing the money to provide that.
70%, according to Director of Corrections. 70%.
And for a lot of years, the notion was, well, you just lock them up and throw away the key. We don't have to do anything with them. We just forget about them. That was sort of the public. And lawmakers fell over themselves trying to impose tougher penalties, longer prison terms, to show that they were tough on crime. But the fact is, most of the people who are in the prison will be out at some point. And the idea of having a correctional system is that we try to correct their behavior, give them the tools that they need, give them counseling if they have substance abuse problems, give them education if they don't have a background, if they've only gone through 4 or 5 years of grade school, try and provide them with some skills, vocational skills, so if there's something for them to do and they can reintegrate into the community when they are released. But all of that stuff takes money, and as we well know, the state doesn't have a whole lot of money to go around.
And of course,
I misspoke, Sean. Excuse me. The 70% figure, according to Corrections Director John Baldwin, is that 70% of the assaults, he says, are perpetrated by inmates with mental illness, and that's the kind of thing that they're emphasizing, is that many times these are mentally ill prisoners who are acting out, and they'll bump or they'll push or they'll throw fluids, et cetera, at a guard.
Yeah, but it is a really high number. In fact, in that the people behind the lawsuit we were discussing earlier, it's called the Rasho lawsuit, where DOC settled. They say they're representing 12,000 mentally ill prisoners, and that the Department of Corrections itself classifies 4,800 and some prisoners as, quote, seriously mentally ill. And they say that there is a crisis and a state of emergency in psychiatric care in the prisons. And that's why this week they were in court, in federal court in Peoria, even though the Department of Corrections agreed to settle this case last year. They're in court now seeking to impose a timeline and some deadlines to force DOC to work harder. The corrections says, you know, they're doing what they can. Their medical provider, Wexford, who has the contract for healthcare in Illinois prisons, is having a hard time finding psychiatrists to come work in particularly some of the remote places where prisons are located downstate. And so, you know, how this ends is going to be interesting to follow. It could take a few years to play itself out, but we know that in other places, like in California, where there was a lawsuit over treatment of inmates, ultimately the courts, and again, this was after many years and a lot of back and forth, the courts ultimately just said you have to start releasing people. You are violating their constitutional rights, and so you have to start releasing people. Director Baldwin here in Illinois says we don't want that to happen. We want to maintain control. We want us and the people of Illinois ultimately to be responsible for and to make determinations about how our prisons are managed, and we don't want to have to go down that road. But it's not an auspicious sign that they're going back. They have to go back to court now on this lawsuit.
Let's move on and talk a little politics this week. As I mentioned at the start, the field of candidates for governor is down another person. This is on the Democratic side. The Chicago alderman, Amaya Pawar, has dropped out of the race. He cited a lack of money, sent out an email to his supporters about this. He wasn't necessarily considered to be maybe the front runner, of course, in the race, but it is an interesting point for him to make this decision now. And John or Brian, I know you've been following this. Pawar's decision, it really shows that it's hard for somebody right now to come in and try to compete with the money that both Bruce Rauner and also J.B. Pritzker on the Democratic side have to put in their campaigns.
Yeah, Alderman Pawar talked about in his email. He wrote a very long email, pretty unusual for a politician, but a long email to supporters. Said we raised $828,000 from more than 2,500 donors. And that does sound like an awful lot of money and an awful lot of people. But if you think about it, one of his, one of the opponents in the Democratic primary, J.B. Pritzker, raised more than, I think it was $28 million so far, if my math is correct. And that was from one donor himself. And it's just mind-boggling the amount of money, and you think that the primary is still months and months away. He has been on TV all year. He has been locking up not only the media environment with his money, but he's also been dominating endorsements, Pritzker has. And so Chris Kennedy and State Senator Daniel Biss are still in the race, as well as a number of other people who are trying to compete. But so far, the endorsements and the money war has been dominated by J.B. Pritzker.
$27 million is the number that sticks in my mind for the amount of money that former Democratic Governor Rod Blagojevich raised for his entire reelection campaign in 2006, which critics just said was obscene. And, of course, in addition to the illegal activities that a jury later found Governor Blagojevich had conducted led to that type of money led to significant reforms in campaign fundraising in Illinois law, but there are still loopholes, if you will, that allow for this kind of self-funding, and it's almost opened the door to an even greater amount. I don't know how anyone can consider running against somebody in a Democratic primary with the money that J.B. Pritzker has, for example. And Chris Kennedy is another front runner who has a significant amount of personal wealth, but he's not even begun spending it yet, and Pritzker's just way out in front.
And he doesn't have Pritzker's kind of wealth, and Rauner doesn't even have Pritzker's kind of wealth, and that's just what's so stunning here. We're and Charlie can probably talk about this a little more, but I mean we're looking at a potentially record-setting, record-smashing race for governor here in Illinois.
And Charlie, I was going to ask you though. I mean, Pawar had to see the writing on the wall. That's what he just figured. Why am I wasting my time in this? Is that what you think he was coming across as?
I think he was looking at it, and he was frustrated by the fact that he didn't have the financial resources to compete at the same level as a Pritzker or presumably a Kennedy or as a Bruce Rauner. And Pawar worked his tail off. He was all over the state. He had worked to build up a grassroots organization. He had thoughtful position papers. He did all the things that you're supposed to do, but he did not have the kind of money to go out and do the paid media, all the social media, the flyers. I've gotten several flyers, probably half a dozen flyers from J.B. Pritzker already, and that's despite the fact that I actually voted in the Republican primary last time around.
Well, let me stop you there, though, because when it comes to Pawar, for example, he's not picking up the endorsements that Pritzker's getting either. So, I mean, and he's quite progressive, which may put him even a little bit outside the norm of the Democratic primary voters in the state. So your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that one of the reasons that he's not picking up the endorsements is that the people who are doing the endorsing look at maybe their own campaigns. They maybe look at other campaigns they're interested in, and they try and say, now, who as our top guy is going to be able to help me? Who's going to have the dollars that they can funnel into my campaign or my interests? And you compare J.B. Pritzker with Amar Pawar, and you see that there's just absolutely no comparison. And, you know, talking about the record spending, the prognostication is that this governor's race in 2018 in Illinois could be the most expensive governor's race ever anywhere in this nation. I think the record is now held in California. Jerry Brown and I think, was it Meg Whitman, ran against them last time. They spent like $250 million between them, most of it from Whitman in a losing cause. We could go over $300 million between the candidates. And my colleague, Kent Redfield, who's been on the show and who's probably the state's foremost expert in campaign finance, has put together kind of the track record for the last several governor's races. Pat Quinn, when he lost in 2014, spent more than any two candidates, Republican or Democrats, did running for governor ever in history. Bruce Rauner spent more than he did. Bruce Rauner spent $54+ million, a lot of it his own money, which is more than Rod Blagojevich and his two Republican opponents together spent in their two elections. So it's just getting crazy. And as I said earlier, the fact that between Quinn and Rauner, $90+ million was spent, this coming election could double or triple that.
And Bruce Rauner has enough money that he's even giving money to the Illinois Republican Party, which he did again. It's called for the 2018 Madigan Retirement Plan. And you guys at the State House, fill us in on what this is all about.
Well, this is, I've lost track of where we are now. Fire Madigan 3.1, 3.5, 4.0. This is the latest iteration of the Republican Party's attempts to use the unpopularity of Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan as a way to try and win electoral support, or excuse me, electoral support here in Illinois. And will it work? Well, the Republicans have long tried this approach and have long not had much success until last year, where they did manage to pick up some seats, mostly downstate. The real question is whether this works in the suburbs and whether it can possibly overcome what a lot of prognosticators are expecting to be a pretty tough year for Republicans nationwide. You have a Republican president who has record low unapproval ratings among the overall electorate. You have a Republican governor whose approval ratings are pretty low. And so will simply reminding some voters that they don't like Mike Madigan be enough to get them over the top? We'll have to wait and see. But I will say I have been struck by how many more people in the past year or two seem to be aware of who Mike Madigan is. I think my thought on these sort of attempts in the past used to be, well, you know, Mike Madigan, that may matter if you are in his particular district in the southwest side of Chicago, but most people don't get to vote for him. But I think that the Republicans have succeeded in making him a household name. And I've even talked to, and this is anecdotal, but I was talking to a group of women who were said that, you know, they vote different ways in different elections, but boy, they were really did not like the way the state was going and thought, you know, maybe Governor Rauner needed to go. But oh, and we need to get rid of that Mike Madigan. We need to get rid of that Speaker Madigan. So the Republicans have been successful in putting his name out there, whether that translates into more seats in the legislature and helping Governor Rauner win re-election. We'll have to wait and see.
Madigan, of course, has the benefit of the map, the democratically drawn map, which we have seen Trump's money almost every time. And in fact, one of the B plot of the gubernatorial race in 2018 is who controls the drawing of the map in 2020. And That may be one thing in Bruce Rauner's favor. The Republicans are going to make sure when it comes to he's faced in intra-party unpopularity over his abortion stance in recent weeks, and there are threats to that conservatives may run against him in a primary. Well, Republicans may decide we need to put all we can behind Bruce Rauner because we're probably not going to win the House or the Senate, and we need to have a governor, a Republican governor, when it comes to drawing the map in 2020.
Governor also making a personnel move in his staff this week, actually a few, but one of the big ones was he replaced his chief of staff, Christina Rasmussen. She, formerly with the Illinois Policy Institute, came over in the summer to this role, and she's been replaced by Roger Heaton. He's a former U.S. attorney. John, I do want to go back to you because you had a report this week about the bill backlog, which, of course, has been so high and we've talked about quite a bit. It seems like it could be higher than we even anticipate.
Well, it's I described it as a moving target. It's Controller Susana Mendoza, who's a Democrat and a thorn in Governor Rauner's side since she took office last year, has pointed out that when it comes to the overdue bills, almost $16 billion now that are past due to vendors and service providers to the state, nearly half of it has not yet reached her desk. In other words, it's being held in the departments that are incurring the debts, and so she doesn't have a good handle on what's coming down the pike. Now, we found out that current law requires once-a-year reporting on October 1st that each agency report on October 1st what it had in bills that it was holding on to as of June 30th. Now, in normal times, when this law was written, it probably was sufficient because bills got paid on time. We're not in those times anymore, Mendoza says. And Mendoza says, I need monthly reporting of what is being held at the agencies, because I need to know how to budget, what bills, you know, I pay bills as they, you know, they're in a line, they're in a queue on my desk, but some bills need to be paid before others. Some bills need to be paid out of certain funds. There are 900 different accounts that the state maintains. And she was behind the legislation in the spring to require this monthly reporting. Governor Rauner said he vetoed it and said it was an attempt to micromanage by Mendoza, micromanage the executive agency. Now, when I had the report earlier this week, the governor's office didn't repeat that criticism, Mendoza, but said rather that we don't have the technology to be able to report monthly, which is something that Mendoza disputes.
And Charlie, do you buy into that?
I don't know if I do or not. I mean, if they can do it once a year, why can't they do it once a month, would be my question. And it occurs to me, Governor Rauner ran as a businessman. He was the guy who had the business savvy. He could come in and clean up the mess that Mike Madigan has made over the last century or so. So I would ask, if you're the businessman and you're ahead of a business, would you be pleased if the bill writing agency or the bill writing department only heard from all the other divisions once a year how much they were sitting on in accrued liabilities? Or would you want that person to know maybe a little sooner? So this idea about micromanagement, I think, is you know, phony baloney. I think it's basically that the governor really doesn't like Mendoza, and anything that Mendoza is for, he's going to be against. And it occurs to me there are a lot of reports that are made by state agencies on a regular basis, monthly, sometimes more frequently. I just find it hard to believe that they can't figure out how many bills they have there on a better basis than annually.
Time now for our notes from the field. Brian Mackey, let's go to you.
Yeah, this is just a bill, as some people say, but I thought it was an interesting one. Representative LaShawn Ford filed legislation to remove sales taxes on certain items for senior citizens. My first thought was, oh, goodness, we already don't make senior citizens, or at least people, I should say, pay income tax on retirement tax, which is kind of a regressive tax, because if you're an older person, you have to work for a living, you do pay taxes. And if you're just collecting retirement income, you're not paying taxes. But this bill is means tested, so it would only be for people receiving certain types of health care assistance or food stamps. But again, just a bill. We'll see what happens to it.
And Charlie?
Well, speaking of just the bills, there was legislation also introduced to kind of counter the legislation Governor Bruce Rauner signed recently that in essence would provide taxpayer-funded abortions kind of on demand. It was filed by a couple of conservatives who were very upset with what the governor did, and what it would do would be to repeal that expansion of taxpayer-funded medical procedures involving abortion.
And that will do it for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler and Brian Mackey, and our guest John O'Connor with the Associated Press. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Production assistance was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.